Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to episode number 334 of the Nerdist Podcast. Hey, I'm doing stand-up. It'd be really great if you came out to see me in April and May and lots of places like New York at Caroline's on the 6th, 7th, and 8th. And then other places like Denver and Portland and D.C. and Baltimore and lots of places. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar and come to a show and we'll meet and say hi. It'll be fun. Oh, and then comedy. There'll be comedy there, I promise. I'd like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Stamps.com is the quick and easy way to print postage on demand for your business or for your personal. Or maybe you want to make it personal but look businessy. Then do that. Be personal but look business. Stamps.com will print out the exact postage you need every time. It's super easy. Why go to the post office? Why do things that you hate? Why? I mean, if you hate yourself and want to punish yourself, by all means go to the post office and be like, I so deserve this. But if you don't want to do that, then print out the postage from home. Do it without clothes on. Because who's going to know that you printed out postage while you were nude? That's between you and your computer. Boy, your computer probably has a lot of dirt on you. So why not print out postage as well? Anything you need. Right now, we have a promo. We usually have a promo going because Stamps.com is a longtime sponsor of the podcast. The promo code is Nerdist. There's a no-risk trial. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That is Stamps.com. And enter the promo code Nerdist. I thank them. This episode is Macklemore. Several months ago, Skydart and I watched the thrift shop video, and it was the greatest thing that we had seen. And then I sort of went down a rabbit hole of Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, and I fucking love all of it. So
Hang on, though. Before we saw the video, we saw they did an AMA, and that's how we ended up seeing the video.
Was that how we...
They were doing an AMA, and I thought that was really cool, and so I looked them up a little bit more, and the thrift shop came up, and I was like, that's awesome.
You're acting right now like you did an AMA, and you just answered a question.
What?
You didn't ask me anything.
You got something in your teeth.
Yeah, like enamel.
No, it's right there.
Stop it. No one on the podcast can... No, they're not listening and going, it sounds like he's got some food in his teeth.
Let me just get rid of it.
No, not while I'm doing the podcast. Just stop it. Mom!
I'm on the podcast, intro, sweetie.
Come on. Hey, bro.
Are you going to finish this intro or what?
Oh, yeah, the intro.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I seem to recall a story where we saw the Macklemore and Ryan Lewis AMA and then went and started watching all the stuff. And so we had him on, and it turns out he actually listens to the podcast. So it's Nerds Podcast number 334 with Macklemore, which, by the way, you should pick up the album The Heist by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Thrift Shop, number one on the Billboard, no label. You can do it out there, people. You can make your own SNA. But you should also listen to their other stuff. There's a really great song called Other Side, which is, I believe, on the Versus Redux, which is an album that he and Ryan Lewis did like in 2010. So check out all their stuff. Listen to this podcast. I love your pants.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Now it's recording. Now we're being judged. You are, you just flew in and came straight for the airport. I cannot thank you enough.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
As a frequent traveler, I know that drill, and it's not the most fun thing in the world, so...
No, you got, like, the, it's the air of the airplane that's starting to wear me down.
It's the dry, recycled...
Yes. Weird... I mean, it's kind of TMI, but the dry booger syndrome.
Yes. Now, I've known some people who will smear Vaseline inside their nostrils to keep out germs and to keep their nose wet. But that
seems
disgusting.
I've done it like once and I forgot. And now I will go back to doing it. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I think I would always just be trying to dig it out. Like, nah, there shouldn't be Vaseline inside my nostrils.
You're probably right.
I can't breathe. Where were you flying in from?
Actually, for the first time in months, I was home. And I flew from Seattle, Washington here.
That's a nice flight.
Yeah, it was.
Did you get a little bit of a break?
No. Well, I mean, if you count like 20 hours as a break, I guess.
Oh, man.
But no break. Just home for a quick second. Enough to do some laundry and get back out.
Oh, that's, you know, doing laundry is really, you can go out, you can perform for like 10,000 people. At the end of the day, you still have to do your laundry.
In a communal space, mind you.
Really?
Yes. I'm keeping it real.
Is there, you have like a neighborhood laundromat?
No, it's in my building. It's downstairs in the basement. And yeah, it's a little bit weird doing laundry and getting congratulated by the people in your building, like, oh, congratulations on SNL is like you're folding your underwear, downstairs.
I just saw you on SNL.
Yeah.
Hey, check it out. Macklemore's in my laundry room folding his underpants.
Exactly. That's happening.
He really is keeping it real.
Mm-hmm.
Is it good? Is it fun? Is it finally? Because you've been at this for like 13 years.
Yeah.
So
ever since I was a small child.
So when it finally all broke, did it feel like yes or oh my god, I'm so tired?
A little bit of both. And there's so many different times that you can kind of consider it like breaking. The last 2 months have been crazy. Absolutely crazy. But there's so many, you know, you hit these kind of points of success that you're like, okay, now I've finally done what I've always wanted to do. And then 2 days later, you're like, I need more. And it's kind of that like human condition, that kind of lack of some sort of spiritual connection where you're always feeling like what you have is not good enough.
Sure.
And right now I feel great in terms of just it's enough. I feel like it's too much. But you know, it's challenging. It's adapting to a different lifestyle. It's you know, being in the public eye and taking pictures when you exit your house pretty much all day long when you're walking around throughout airports and through the mall and getting food and all of that. It's a different life than I have been accustomed to the past couple of years.
Do you feel like you're always being judged now? Does it feel a little invasive or can you roll with it pretty well?
I wear sunglasses more. I feel like I'm that guy that's like, you know, hiding behind some sort of Ray-Bans. But, you know, what I'm learning is that you just have to have fun with it. Yeah. This could be gone next year. It could be gone in 6 months. You never know. And for where we're at right now, it's really exciting. Obviously, privacy is an issue that has changed, but for the most part, it's something that I've worked my whole life to get to. I want to enjoy it. You learn how to operate off of like 3 hours of sleep or less, and you do your best.
I mean, obviously, you know, you've had, like you said, you've had success all along the way in the last 13 years. Now it's like mega, mega success. But I think the fortunate thing for you is that you have this 13 years behind you.
Yeah.
And you have stops and starts, and you have stuff to learn from, and because if you were like 20 years old and all of a sudden blam,
exactly,
that could fucking kill you.
Thank God I'm 55.
You look great.
you're exactly right. Like, and I probably would have literally died at 20 years old if this kind of happened to me overnight. And you look at people that do, Can I cuss?
Yeah, say whatever you want.
Good. People get fucked up, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very vicious industry, and I think that I'm learning that as well. The bigger that you get, the more people are out there judging you. The more love, the more hate that comes with it. It's the double-edged sword of success. And if I didn't have kind of a grounded foundation of who I am as a person, who I am as an artist, what actually matters in life, which waxes and wanes, I forget that on a daily basis as well. But at 20, I was a lot less rooted in myself as a human. So thankfully, I've got some more years, and I could, you know, I can take this in stride as much as possible.
Well, and I think that's the most important thing, because it is, you know, the success thing is a weird addiction, and you get so acclimated to, oh, I know, like you said, I know I want that, but oh, there's other. I mean, do you ever feel like there's a point? Do you need that to continue to be an artist? Do you think you need that kind of drive, that there's something that you always need to fill to create more?
Ideally, that comes from the art itself, I think. The purest place possible is just wanting to make art for the sake of making art. I think that people get the work, the craft becomes convoluted when your main objective is to match what you sold last time. Now we need to make another thrift shop because we sold 4 million thrift shops. We need to make another one. That's never going to happen.
That would be called Sir Mix-a-Lot's Put 'em on the Glass. They were like, come on, man, you got to do one more of those. Yeah. Fuck, really?
What's another body part? You've already talked about asses. Move on to titties. That's when the art starts to suffer. And, you know, I think all artists go through it. And I think that that's the benefit of not being on a label, is that you don't have, you know, some old white dude in a suit telling you what to rap about because this worked last time. Yeah. But I think that there is, you know, success drives people. Competition, you know, I'm a rapper, like hip hop in particular. MCs are a very competitive species of human being. There's something that's very publicly competitive within the sport of being a rapper. You know, I mean, my manager and I talk about it sometimes. It's like, I don't know if there's these indie rock guys. You know, like right now, currently there's this list that MTV does every year called, you know, the hottest MC list. And they pick the top hottest MCs in the game right now. And this gets the whole industry completely riled up. I mean, you have Kanye, who doesn't do any press at all, calling into different radio stations, debating his place at number 7 on the list, and all these different grown men bitching about their spot that, you know, a round table of 5 people chose their ranking. I don't think that you have indie rock people like sitting around bitching about, you know, some make-believe list.
They do, they just don't do it publicly.
Exactly. There you go. It's not public. But as an MC, it's very public. Everything is very much out there. So I think in terms of, I can only speak for myself, in terms of a rapper, there is a competition. There is I want to be the best at my craft.
Sure.
I think it's just some male testosterone bullshit. But.
Well, it's that. I'm sure it's that. But I think it also has a lot to do with, I mean, when you take any other genre of music, it's very difficult to make a qualitative judgment and say, this band is the best band.
Exactly.
But with rappers, there's this skill set is so out in front that there is, you can kind of see a linear hierarchy almost you know, who's
doing
original stuff. So I do understand that. But the competition does, you know, it drives you to make better stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, is it, I always wonder with a hit this, I mean, like Thrift Shop, I mean, I caught it several months ago and of course immediately was like, holy fuck. I mean, it just grabs you. That song just grabs you, and the video's brilliant. And even from a comedian standpoint, I'm like, God damn it. The point of view, like everything that song, the subject matter has been right there the whole time and no one talked about it.
Yeah.
And but then I also see the, wow, it gets so huge. Is that sort of haunting in a weird sort of way? Is it daunting because of how big it got?
You know, I think it's to be determined. At times, I think it is. You never want to be known as the thrift shop guy. And to the majority of the world, although we have an album that has done really well and for the most part been critically acclaimed and got great press, and the fans seem to love it, and you know, the touring is great, all that sort of stuff that's happening outside of Thrift Shop, I'm still known as that Thrift Shop guy by the majority of the world.
But I think that can change. I mean, look, you know, Beck could have just been the loser guy, or Radiohead could have just been the creep band.
Absolutely.
You know? But it really is about the body of, or Beastie Boys could have just been the Fight for Your Right to Party guys, which was a joke.
You're exactly right.
So you'll be okay.
So time will tell, and I think that it comes down to making good music. Now, will we have another song again that goes on to sell 4 million copies or 5 million or wherever Thrift Shop stops at? I don't even know if I hope for that, you know? Because it does take you to a different level of pop culture celebrity that you're almost like, did I sign up for this? This is what I signed up for.
Right.
Getting off the airplane and immediately taking 50 pictures the second that I get off. That this is what I wanted. This was my idea of success. So I don't know. It's a weird world. Thrift Shop, at a certain point, it took off and it's not yours anymore.
Right.
For so long, you're in control of like, okay, what am I doing? How am I getting out to the masses? We make this video. All of a sudden, the video goes viral and radio gets it. And once radio got it, it's gone. And you don't have any control over your song. And that's kind of a scary thing.
But it is pretty, I mean, it's... I think the other truly remarkable thing about it is that, and it should be kind of scary to the music, even, you know, even as I just read an article, like, the music industry didn't go down a bunch for the first time in years and years and years. Like, it kind of went up like 0.3%, and that's very positive.
Yeah,
but to see you and Ryan Lewis come out of Seattle just making stuff that you like making with no label, and like, oh, you're at the top of the charts,
yeah,
and all these people are talking about the song. I mean, that's a great story. That's just a great story.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It is a very cool story. It's what you always hope for in terms of picking the independent path. Like, and it's cool to see that has been a focal point. It's not just Thrift Shop. It's this kind of do-it-yourself attitude behind the music that we've made that is also kind of within the midst of this whole Thrift Shop song, that these two dudes chose to go independently, turn down the major labels, that the music industry is changing, that it's evolving, and to be at any sort of place where we're, you know, at the forefront of that at the moment is exciting.
Well, that's it's so inspiring to so many young people who maybe, and I think people are more and more used to the fact that they can just make stuff in their bedrooms and then it can turn out to be
exactly
huge. But every time that happens, it's that much more inspiring to a younger generation of people who go, you know, I think the broader message beside just that, hey, it's a fun, catchy song that everyone loves, is like, there's no excuse anymore for you to not go out and make the stuff that you want. There's literally no excuse.
Absolutely. And that's what, you know, we watched people that came before us that have done it independently, whether it's Sub Pop or whether it's, you know, I think it was 2011 it came out, but Mac Miller did it independently, and he had every label hollering at him with huge seven-figure offers and turned it down and still went number one on Billboard. There's examples of it that came before us that we were like, I think that this can work. I'm not sure if it can work, but at the end of the day, what's the most important? And creative control is number one for Ryan and I, and it's a no-brainer.
So obviously, I'm sure you've been approached a million times at this point, but you still don't want the infrastructure of a label. You guys are happy to...
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason to do it. With the power of the internet and with the real personal relationship that you can have via social media with your fans, with really, I mean, everyone talks about MTV and the music industry or the MTV, you know, they don't play videos anymore or whatever. YouTube has obviously completely replaced that. It doesn't matter that MTV doesn't really play videos. It matters that, you know, we have YouTube, and that has been our greatest resource in terms of connecting, having an identity, creating a brand, showing the world who we are via YouTube. That has been our label. That's, and labels will go in and spend, you know, $1 million or hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to brand these artists, and they have no idea how to do it. There's no authenticity. They're trying to follow a formula that's dead. And Ryan and I, out of anything, I would say that we're good at making music, but we're great at branding. We're great at figuring out what our target audience is, how we're going to reach them, and how to do that in a way that is real and true to who we are as people, because that's where the substance is. That's where the people actually feel that real connection, and labels don't have that. So you sign up for a label, there's not some magic button that now they're going to push and it means that people are going to like who you are or they're going to identify with your vision or your songs. It actually comes from sitting down, staring at a piece of paper for months or years on end, trying to figure out who you are as a person, documenting that on a record and hoping that it connects. But a label's not going to do that for you.
No, because any major industry is essentially run by marketing people, and they look at data points, and they don't understand what really makes something. I think they don't really understand, most of them anyway, maybe some do, don't really understand what makes something work. So a standard, I think, record company or like a marketing person would look at Thrift Shop and go, oh, so what kids want to hear,
yeah, exactly,
is a song about,
yeah,
buying used clothes.
That's what it is.
No,
God.
It's really about these guys who had a story to tell, and that was their specific story, and you should let creative people be creative.
Exactly. And it was something that was completely different than anything else that was out there at the time. And that's what radio doesn't understand. That's what labels don't understand, is that the masses, and the masses meaning real masses, the people, not a niche demographic, not 500 people at a concert, not 1,000 people or even 10,000 people, general pop culture audience, they're not as dumb as we think that they are. Now, sure, they go to the same station and they want to listen to the same four songs every hour and repeat that throughout their day. But in terms of what those four songs are, there can be a diversity. It doesn't have to, you know, all kind of go in this line of sounding like the song that preceded it. And that's what people don't get. And I didn't think that Thrift Shop would ever have a chance at radio because of that. I thought the same thing. I thought that it was a niche song. It was going to hit a certain demographic. That demographic was not going to reach pop culture in the way that, you know, a top 40 type of song ever would. And here we are 4 million copies later and
140 million views. Yeah. But besides that song, I hope that people take time to go down the rabbit hole of your music, because there's such great stuff. I mean, the second video that I saw of yours was Same Love, which is such a great, it's just so nice. Like I, you know, when there's so much sort of like posturing, and I'm admittedly like not a big hip hop guy,
yeah,
but it was like, oh, here's a guy who has some people's attentions and he's going to make a song about something that he really cares about, which is like that, like why so much homophobia? Like what's the point of that? And yeah, telling and really kind of shaming people for being homophobic, which is it was great. And the song is also just great.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
So where do you start from? Do you start from the music side, or do you go, oh, this is something that I really want to talk about? And then does the music sort of reveal itself to you as to what it should be?
It can go both ways. Ryan and I have, you know, it just depends on the song. With Same Love, I knew that I wanted to address the issue of homophobia, of equality, of same-sex marriage. There's all this going on in my head, like, okay, how do I do this as a straight man? How do I put this into a song? But this is important to me. And there's so many hip-hop songs, albums out there that are critically acclaimed, that are completely flooded with homophobic language that get great reviews and no one ever says anything about it. You know, if there was just some blatant racist out there on a hip hop record, even if it was a great, even if it was really talented, people would call him out for being a blatant racist. The fact that you can still be in 2013 a rapper, be completely homophobic, and no one says anything is insane to me. Along with just the epidemic of kids getting bullied and in school and committing suicide at the age of like 12 and 13 for who they are. And I knew that I wanted to do it. I didn't know how to write the song. And Ryan had a piano loop. Actually, a friend of mine played a piano loop. His name's Noah Goldberg. And he played this loop and I started, and it just kind of wrote itself. It wasn't a track. There was no drums. It just kind of came from that. And a lot of times it can come that way, usually just from a sketch or just from a concept. Thrift Shop I wrote to a different beat, and I had written kind of different Thrift Shop ideas for years before that song actually turned into something. Because I knew that I wanted to write a song about thrift shopping. It just happened to come out in 2013. So it all kind of changes depending on the song.
Yeah. Do you work anything out on stage, or do you work it out alone and then record it and then perform it?
Everything is, for the most part, just in the studio or in my house or whatever weird location I'm trying to get inspired. Like with this album, I would go to like graveyards and I would go to art museums and weird places with views and try to catch some holy ghost of a spirit to write when writer's block was whooping my ass. But yeah, and then we go in the studio, record it, and then it goes out to the world eventually.
So that's your solution for writer's block, is just to change your environment a little bit and kind of get to some
different
places.
Writer's block, it's like let me try anything possible to break this son of a bitch, because there's nothing worse as an artist to really hit that point of like, I have nothing to say. I have no idea what to do. You know, I try to read, I try to have conversations, I take walks, but sometimes it's just not there.
It's weird. It's almost like you get writer's block, your body wants to say something, but your brain is like, why are you looking at me?
Exactly. That's exactly it.
It's that frustrating, like, God, no, I need to. Yeah. Like, you have the need, but then the thing is empty.
Yeah, the thing is empty. And it's really frustrating. I mean, the process of being a writer is such a daunting, insecure, this kind of love-hate relationship. You know, there's times where you're like, oh my God, I'm a genius. This is crazy. But the majority of the time, you're like, I fucking suck. And this album is never going to get finished. And I shouldn't be doing this for a living. And I'm not going to be able to do this for a living because no one's going to buy this crap. There's kind of this forever flux of back and forth between those two places.
But isn't it kind of comforting to know that almost everyone goes through that? Like, I mean, even at every level, that people don't have the proper perspective on their own work, but you still go, why would I think this would be something? But I think the people who persevere and put stuff out anyway and try stuff and take risks, I mean, they're the ones who push through.
Yeah, I guess there is some comfort in that. It instills some sort of faith within the creative process that this is just part of the job. And the thing that's scary is that you never know how long it's going to last. It's like if you knew, you're like, all right, for these 3 months, I'm going to suck and I'm going to hate myself and I'm going to be suicidal. That's okay if you knew that. That would be, and then I'm going to break in and I'm going to write an incredible record and it's all going to be fine and then I'm going to get back on my game. But you never know. And I think that as a writer who's been writing, you know, over half my life, it's that I don't know if I still have it. Like, what if I'm dried up? What if these songs, this is it? But I think that's what, you know, whether it's through the medium of music or whether it's writing something else or, you know, writing a play or writing a script or whatever it is, writing is woven within the fabric of who I am. And if you can let go of kind of like, I need to be writing raps all the time and just write for the sake of writing, that's how I tend to break out of those cycles of, you know, I suck at my job.
Well, that's the artistic approach as opposed to the famous approach, where the famous approach is, how do I recapture the magic? And the artistic approach is, I just need to keep writing. And
I can
tell you, as someone who definitely, you know, deals with anxiety and self-doubt, my unsolicited advice would be, don't try not to ask questions that start with what if. They're never good questions. They're never good questions.
That's true. I should tattoo that on my knuckles.
Don't ask what if. Because when you ask, you know, your brain is smart and stupid, I think, which is it's smart because whatever question you ask it, it will paint that picture in your head. And it doesn't matter if it's ridiculous or if it's a real thing or not a real thing, but what if I never write another song again? And then all of a sudden, this very clear picture of what that looks like just mm-hmm. gets in your brain.
Absolutely.
But your brain's just doing its job. It's retrieving information for you.
Yeah. And it's such a fear. There's so much fear within the process of being creative. What are the people going to think? What, you know, the judgment that comes up of being an artist. And, you know, the best songs are written when you're not thinking about anybody else. They just kind of flow through you. It comes from something much greater than the pen that's in my hand. And yet, the criticism and the fear is there, and the brain is active. And I think that it comes down to training the brain to be overridden by the heart when you're writing a song. And that's a very challenging process. It's a lifelong process. It's not something that you hit one day and you're like, all right, I'm 29 years old, I figured this out. This is something that takes practice and maintenance, really. It's just like a muscle. If you don't work it, that fear is gonna beat you eventually.
And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure some people, particularly in our culture, will go, what problems could that guy have? He's got a hit record now. Blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but he's still the same guy. Like, that didn't, you were a person with a series of problems or circumstances or good things or bad things. And those didn't change just because other people were like, hey, that's a great song.
Yeah. And the funny thing is with that is that, you know, I was always one of those guys. It's like, oh, shut up. You're a millionaire and you know, have a house and you have a model wife and, you know, you drive a Ferrari. Fuck you. Like, nothing's wrong with you. Not that I have any of those things, although my fiance is gorgeous. But besides that, there is nothing changes. And that's the weird thing is that you're the exact same person with the exact same set of problems, with the exact same set of insecurities. It's just magnified in terms of the public eye. So, yeah, I could probably say I was happier 6 months ago before Thrift Shop turned into this 4 million, you know, downloaded monster. I'm figuring it out. It's like I said before, I'm figuring out how to live normally or as normal as I can right now. But the level of scrutiny and the media and all of the criticism that comes with having a song that's as big as Thrift Shop is challenging. And I'm learning how to deal with that. And I wish I could say I don't read anything. I don't read any of the comments. I don't read any of the press. But I do. And you live in that world where, like, all of a sudden it's like having a great day and something pops up on a screen, a tweet or something, and it's like, oh shit, the such and such just shat all over my entire album. Like,
well, some people go like, well, don't let that get to you. And you're like, yeah, I know, but the double-edged sword is that by nature, people who are artistically inclined are more sensitive to the world
sensitive.
Yes, and a lot of what we do is because we're dealing with sensitivity and insecurities, or you're able to write a song. You're able to write a song like Same Love because you're sensitive to the world and something that's going on. So yeah. When someone gets in your face and they're like, you piece of shit, you how fucking dare. You're like, what did I do? I'm a guy. I just made a thing. What are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
But of course, in turn, I know that we've done the same thing with other people.
And then you've ruined people's lives.
We've ruined people's lives before. And, it's a disgusting circle.
You know, you try to take it in stride. And for the most part, I would say in terms of the criticism that comes at me, it's fine. Like, there's very little that you can say about me that I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea that someone could look at me in that way. You know? Oh my God, he called me Vanilla Ice. My feelings are so hurt right now. Like, I've heard it all. And it's
Was the person Vanilla Ice who said that?
Vanilla Ice called me Vanilla Ice. No, there's a series of you know, things that you hear on a daily basis, and those type of things don't bother you at all. But every once in a while, when it will just hit you at a certain time, and it's like, man, and depending on the credibility of the person writing, you know, like something coming from Rolling Stone means more than coming from a random blogger, even though that random blogger just so happened to get a job at Rolling Stone.
Sure.
It's just one person.
Sure.
But there is, as comes the success, there does come the hate, and you try to maneuver through both of it and remain in the middle in terms of your ego, in terms of your confidence, in terms of your insecurity, and try to just remain the human that you always have been. And that's the interesting thing about this, is that I'm not, you know, living in LA right now in a mansion. I'm living in the place that, you know, I pay $1,300 a month for a two-bedroom apartment in Seattle. Like, I haven't moved. I'm doing my laundry downstairs. Nothing has really changed. I haven't had time to change my lifestyle. I'm sitting in the middle of coach and flying down to LA today. It's just everything is the same that it was, you know, 6 months ago. Yet, on this other scale, life is very different.
Well, I think it's important. Well, first of all, any major change, no matter what it is, if there's something horrible or something amazing, or someone wins the lottery or they lose a family member or something, any major change is tough for your brain to adjust to quickly, because you get comfortable and there are patterns, and you get into this comfort zone, and you start to feel like, okay, this is probably what I deserve.
Yeah.
And then all something crazy happens. You're like, oh my God, I can't breathe up here. It's like being, yeah, it's like being, you know, dragged up to the edge of the atmosphere where the oxygen's light, and you get a little lightheaded.
That's,
you know,
that's a good image, and it's very accurate.
But if you can ride it out, you'll readjust. I tend to think that having good personal relationships is part of the key, is having a nice foundation of people to keep you grounded, people that care about you and not about the other stuff. I think that's helpful.
Absolutely. That's number one. And, you know, as things grow, those people in your life are extremely important. They're always important, but you start to feel like, and after I say this, then we can move on to something else. I feel like I'm like turning into that guy that's like, oh God, look at my life. Like, this
is
so hard.
But I don't think it's coming off that at all. I think it's coming off as you're at a very unique point right now that most people may never experience, and a handful of people have been able to experience. But, you know, your world has sort of been upended.
Yeah.
And you're a human being, and you are just trying to figure it out. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. What I was going to say is that I think that you begin to feel isolated. That friends that you grew up with, even close friends that you still keep in contact with, no one really knows what's going, how you feel. Like, you get it. But you feel like people just don't get it. This is something that's very bizarre. It's strange. It's not normal life. And who can relate to this? Who can I actually talk to that's going to be able to empathize with what I'm going through right now? I don't know anybody that really can. And it's a kind of a lonely place. And that's why the last like 48 hours I've just been like, all right, I'm just going to have fun, and I'm going to laugh about this and not take it too seriously. But yeah, there's times, you know, I mean, just a couple days ago after like SNL, and I haven't slept, and I'm in a green room in Colorado, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, I have no one I can call right now. Like, literally in my life, I don't know anybody I can call. I'm gonna get a hold of my mom, who was like my go-to.
Yeah.
But I have no one that I can call and be like, you know what I'm going through. And that's a strange, strange feeling.
It's weird too, because sometimes you're looking at somebody and you're talking to it, and you can just see that face they have where they aren't able to process that emotion because they've never felt it. Yeah. And you're just like, I know you're empathizing, but you just don't have that software installed to get what this feels like.
Software installed.
Good call, Kyle Clark.
Thank you.
Kyle Clark, big music nerd. Huge music nerd.
I'm waiting to talk hip-hop once we get the emotions out the way.
Good.
How was SNL? Did you have fun?
I did. I had, it was nerve-wracking. I mean, it's live television. It's and they're crazy because they're running around, you know, doing hair and makeup for everyone there, and all the skits are changing and the sets are changing, and it's very fast-paced. And we were actually in a skit that they cut us out of, like, last minute. So that was the perfect, like, in-between of, like, feeling really relieved and, like, slightly angry and hurt at sure. the same time. But enough, like... But it turned into just kind of motivation. And we would have done the skit, got out of our outfit, and gone on stage, like, I think 3 minutes. We had 3 minutes to change.
Yeah.
So we didn't have to do the skit. So that helped. But I had a really good time. The cast was super cool. Kevin Hart was hilarious. Everyone was, you know, for the most part, you know, seemed like they were genuine fans of the music, which tripped me out, which I'm sure they tell every guest, musical guest, that they're a fan of them every week, but they seem pretty genuine, and it was a great, I mean, it's SNL. It's like, I can't believe I'm fucking here.
And I'm just imagining the studio is a lot smaller than you think it's going
to
be.
Yeah, all TV studios are. I remember going to The Price is Right a couple years ago, and I walked in there and I was like, whoa.
It's really small.
It's really small. Like, Bob Barker looked like he was in front of, like, thousands of people when I was a kid.
Tiny studio. Yeah. We do, I shoot it, we do Talking Dead one floor up from Price is Right. And so whenever we have guests come on, we'll take them down. And I don't think I'm supposed to be doing this, but they leave the wheel in the hallway.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, fucking spin the wheel. What do I care?
And it's amazing that to a person, each one's face just childlike excitement.
The wheel is
getting
literally
to put their hand on it.
The wheel is the most famous person they've ever seen.
It's true.
Absolutely true.
And it's heavy too.
It's very heavy.
I've spun it myself. Or actually, it had like a tarp over it or something, so I couldn't exactly. I kind of like did like a rock back and forth thing, but yeah, man, the wheel.
You know,
it's like meeting a president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
way
then,
better.
Then you can't. I remember, you know, just watching Price is Right and seeing some poor soccer mom get up and not be able to get the wheel all the way around and be like, "Come on, put some elbow grease into
I'm
it."
I'm a sick 9-year-old. I could do this.
Yeah. And then you realize it's like, no, the wheel's a little heavy.
Yeah,
they make
you
it hard.
The key is you got to go up and then get that little momentum going.
Yeah. What do you? Is there anything that you do for yourself? Do you play games? Do you have a hobby? What do you like to do?
Watch Price is Right.
Yeah, do do do. Yeah, do do do.
What do we do? I travel. We have very little free time right now.
Sure, of course.
But any time it's downtime, I like to hang out with my fiance, just chill out, catch up on life, get some rest, kind of recuperate. You know, I mean, just typical stuff. There's nothing really crazy that I do at this point in my life.
Seattle's a great town.
Yeah.
I'm mad at your weather a lot of the time, but I love Seattle.
Yeah, the weather
as a city.
Is, it's horrible, man. And even coming down here... And coming down here, and it's actually overcast today, which I'm like, fuck you, LA. The one day that
and it's
I'm
been
here,
great this yeah, whole rest of the time.
Like, and it always
days,
is.
2 days, it's a little cloudy.
But we were living, or we stayed here for the month of January. And I really, really like this place. You realize why everyone gets famous and moves here, or moves here and then gets famous.
Yeah.
It's the shit. The weather's incredible.
It is, but Seattle has such a, I mean, we sort of, you know, if you look at Silver Lake Echo Park, we have a little bit of Seattle-esque culture here.
Except they're smarter in Seattle than in Silver Lake.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Take that,
smarter.
Silver Lake.
Whoa, take it easy, Kyle. I have a bowling team based in Silver Lake.
I'll go with Echo Park then.
Yeah, fuck Echo Park. Bumbershoot. I've done Bumbershoot, like the comedy stage, like three or four times, and that festival is such a good vibe to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Bumbershoot is, you know, a huge festival that I grew up going to. I don't know how many thousands of people go to it, but it occupies the Seattle Center, which is the kind of the downtown area. And yeah, great energy, great vibe. We used to sneak in as kids. That was the whole kind of like mission of the year, was like how you were going to sneak into Bumper Shoot with your malt liquor in your backpack. How are you going to sneak in to Bumper Shoot?
You're
going to
penetrate the perimeter.
Yes, exactly. Now, there I mean, there was like some very MacGyver-esque moves pulled to get into the grounds of Bumper Shoot.
I almost feel like there should be an allowance that if you can figure out a way to get in, then security's like, you made it.
You got it.
Good for you.
You got it.
You get to stay.
You hit a certain point, you hit a finish line, and all of a sudden you can drink your malt liquor as a 15-year-old and you're fine.
You see all these other
no laws.
You see,
for,
you
like
see all
hours.
These other like feral teens like caught in the barbed wire and you're just grabbing their backpack and supplies and tearing them. If you make it, you get to stay.
I completely agree.
Who was the act that you were like, all right, we gotta figure out, I bought bolt cutters, we are getting into this?
Oh man. You know, I don't know exactly if there was like ever one act. Well, there was Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang was there, but that was later in life. I could actually afford a ticket at that point. The first concert that I remember going to was George Clinton.
Ooh, oh, yeah.
P-Funk
That's
All-Stars
a good way to start.
At Bumper Shoot. And I got very high on contact as a small child.
That's such a. I saw that show. I saw his show once, and it's. We were shooting it for something, and they go. So the band's going to play for a while, and then George just comes out whenever he feels like it.
Yeah, right.
There's, like, the guy in the diaper, and and then literally, like, 35 minutes in, then George just came out and mumbled something into the microphone. I don't know.
Yeah, George Clinton does whatever the fuck he wants to do.
It's one of those genius anomalies in music where you're just like, this guy got away with this crazy plan. And like, we'll just all look real crazy and I'll sort of front this, but sort of have a nebulous
job. I'll put all of my friends on three buses and we'll just be this caravan of fun.
We'll be funky gypsies forever.
It's true. It's like the ultimate kind of fantasy escape music. I mean, and a great sound. And a sound that he invented, but you know, the fact that he's like got to be like 70 or he's up there still doing the same shit, the same amount of drugs, if not more.
And anytime you can have a band where Bootsy Collins is the second craziest person in the group is really impressive.
Absolutely.
I just get the image that George Clinton just sires this weird pyramid scheme of children. Like, there's this weird, they live on a compound somewhere. That may not be the case, but it just feels like he is the sort of the figurehead of this, you know,
elaborate mafia funk.
Exactly.
Maybe I love that he had two bands at one point so that he could make twice the money on two labels. That he had Parliament and Funkadelic, so he was just gaming the system.
Yeah, it's
pretty smart. For some reason, just on a weird, almost unrelated side note, I could not get the song Motown Philly out of my head this morning. Ooh. It got trapped.
Oh.
And I even turned on like Jurassic 5 in the car to try to flush it out.
Doesn't work.
And it didn't work.
No.
But
now that's definitely going to be in my head for the rest of the day.
I'm so sorry. Well, here, I'll do that one Jurassic 5 guy. He's the guy that talks down here like this. I always just wait for his parts to come on.
With the super deep voice?
Yeah, the super deep voice.
Yeah.
Kicking the rhymes in a super deep time. Like, it's like, it just comes out of nowhere. And even though I know it's coming up, I'm always like, it's him! But like, I get so excited. There's even one song where like, someone's talking and then the phone rings and they pick up. And on the other end, he's like, kicking the rhymes in a super deep time. And then it was him rapping on the phone as the other side of the phone call.
That made me so happy.
Who do you still? Who do you like now that you're listening to? Voice. Oh,
that's
great.
It. No. Who do I like now in terms of?
Yeah.
Music?
What are you listening to?
What am I listening to? Kendrick Lamar is, you know, I think right now the best rapper in the game in terms of lists.
That record's almost annoyingly good.
Yeah.
Because you, like, I don't know, like, I feel like there's that certain like. If you really like something and everybody says how good something is, you want to be the one pulling away. And then,
does.
But that's one of those goddamn records where, no, it is. All of this hype is warranted. Good. It is that good.
Exactly. I mean, he made a conceptual album that is a story and a narrative and documents his life in a way that, you know, if you go through kind of the criteria of what makes a good writer, what makes a good rapper, he's fitting somebody that can write hooks, that has melody. he's kind of hitting every single point of criteria with flying colors. It's just an incredible record. That's my favorite one of 2012. What else am I listening to? I've actually, it sounds kind of cliche, but I've been going back and listening to a lot of, you know, 90s hip hop. I'm not really like somebody that lives in like, oh, 1994, like nothing compares to 1994, kids. Like, I'm not really that guy, but
It was all over after This Is How We Do It.
Exactly. After Montel, nothing was the same.
I so wanted to make a terrible parody video where it just goes, this is how to do it, and then just like a Howdy Doody puppet on a loop for an hour on YouTube. Just an hour, just to, where people watch for like 30 minutes. They're like, he can't keep this up for another 30 minutes. This is how to do it, just over and over again. That was something Mike Furman and I wanted to do. I wish we had done it.
It's not too late.
That's so funny. You grew up in Seattle, so that you're this sort of like counter movement to what people perceive to be the Seattle music scene.
Yes.
There's actually this hip hop underbelly.
Yes, I am a white guy. I should be listening to Alice in Chains. Obviously, Seattle grunge, growing up in Seattle, I mean, in the 90s, it was the mecca of grunge. It was what you were supposed to like, and I just was listening to Snoop Dogg instead. I don't know exactly how it happened, but the culture in Seattle, and still, I mean, the indie rock that comes out of Seattle now is, you know, some of the best indie rock in the world.
Agreed.
I don't know what it is. I don't know what exactly it is about Seattle. We have a long lineage of great musicians, from Quincy Jones and Jimi Hendrix to, you know, Kurt Cobain and Sir Mix-a-Lot and all the indie rock in between. So.
I think it's because Seattle is it's a dramatic city. You can sort of feel the emotional core of Seattle when you're there. Maybe it's the weather, maybe it's where it's situated on the water, and it's, I don't know what it is, but
we're just depressed.
We have depressed people make good artists. There's a lot of shit you guys got to work out.
Exactly.
If you lived in Los Angeles, the weather's great.
Nah, we're around women and beaches and dog parks.
We get
and
very
shit.
Little done here.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think you need?
You guys are so tan.
This is tan. I'm almost fucking transparent. I'm the whitest. I'm like one of those fish where you can see their skeleton inside. I feel like a guppy. But do you think you need struggle and pain? Do you think that drives art? Or
yes. I mean, I don't think you need it. I think that it helps write certain types of songs. I've never, like, when I'm super happy and I'm like, life is awesome, I'm usually not like, let me find a piece of paper and write about how awesome my life is.
Do you allow yourself to be happy?
That's a good question. I would like to say yes. I've had, in terms of happiness, my life has been, I've been, for the most part, sober now for the last 4 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And up until that point, you know, it was always substances were kind of dictating where I was at on the happiness scale, kind of where I was in terms of the high or the drunk or whatever it might have been. And for the most part, I consider myself a happy person. I think that, as we were talking about the brain earlier, it comes down to us for the most part, and it does take a certain level of training and a level of gratitude for wherever you're at in life to be grateful for that moment. And, you know, I mean, it sounds kind of cliche and hippie, but that's kind of the philosophy that I subscribe to in terms of, my spirituality, and in terms of really being happy, and in terms of having a level of happiness that is lasting, that's not contingent upon a good review or a good song that I'm writing or a good interview or a good show or whatever. It's just a general acceptance of this is the now, I'm learning from this, and I'm progressing as a person, and I'm enjoying it as I go through it. But there's definitely times where life sucks, and those are all the records that you end up hearing on the album.
So your pain is our gain in terms of fantastic music. Thank you for suffering with it.
Yes.
Well, I know. I mean, you know, people are sick of hearing me mention this on the podcast, but I'm sober too, and I've been sober for a long time, and I remember those moments of using, you know, in my case, it was just a lot of alcohol to suppress not just bad feelings, but good feelings, too.
Yeah.
Like, just to not feel anything.
Exactly. Like, getting off stage and feeling great, and then the first thing you want to do is numb that feeling. And you're like, why do I feel great? Like, I have all these endorphins pumping, and I'm, you know, I feel vibrant and full of life, and I've just performed in front of X amount of people, and life is good, and I want to not feel this. Why is that? What's going on with me? So my life has been kind of this roller coaster of going in and out of that. And, you know, eventually leading to deep, dark, isolated depression in a shitty apartment 4 years ago where I was like, I should probably get some help.
Yeah. And you did.
And I did.
Good. Good. And you feel a lot better now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't know who I was if I wouldn't have gotten sober. There was no, there's no middle ground. There was no like, oh, I can kind of write music when I'm fucked up. It was like, no, I'm smoking weed and playing at PlayStation and jacking off and taking a nap.
I think sounds like a full day.
Yeah, it is. Well, over and over again.
Well, I think that's also an important message for young artists, because I think there is this mythos of like, you know, the artist has to be fucked up to open up their mind, man.
Yeah,
it's like, well, you know, it's, I think what a lot of people don't see is that it's not just like, oh, you're going to get really fucked up and then just roll over and scrawl something in a notebook. Like, it takes work and there's discipline, and you,
absolutely,
people, you know, people don't see, they're never going to see the amount of work that you put into stuff or the amount of, you know, emotional labor that you put into things, but you really need all of your faculties to maintain that level of energy.
Yeah, no, the people that do get fucked up and roll over and write songs, I do not understand that. Like, I literally cannot comprehend that. You're right. It's the amount of discipline and structure and just clocking hours and focus it takes to write songs and make an album, where you have a bunch of shitty songs and you let those go and you keep the good ones. And it takes so much time, energy, patience, dedication to the craft that maybe I just am a stupid drug addict. That's probably it. You know, I just, everything just shuts off. There's no creativity. There's nothing that's spawning like, okay, now I feel like I can do this better. It's like, no, I just really need to sleep. And
but I think some of it's that myth that gets created, because it's a lot sexier to show guy who rolls over and is just brilliant.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But even in that case, like, you're not looking at the 15 hours they're spending writing on something and throwing things away. And so I think it's easy for people going into creative fields to go, well, you just sort of work on it.
Yeah, but I think people don't. I think it's almost not a romantic idea of art that it's a job.
Yeah.
That there's a process to it, that it should just feel like this fucking bolt of lightning just strikes out of nowhere because you're just a creative storm. It's like, no. You have to write, in most cases, I feel like, I'm guessing, you got to write like 50 shitty things before that one thing.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And drugs just, you know, fucked up my storm, man, for a really long time.
Well, the good news is for you is that you realized that while you were young. You know,
I did. It took me a really long time to actually live that and get the tools that I needed to stay sober. But I did. I mean, I knew it from the very beginning. I knew it from the fucking first time that I got drunk. I was like, whoa, okay, like, I can't stop.
Like that a little
most
too much.
People.
Yeah. Do you remember talking to people and they would go, I just don't feel like, dude, they'd stop after a drink. And you're like, how do you do that?
Yeah. How do you do that? That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah. There's a whole stack of beer here. Why would you not in your tummy?
Exactly.
But I think, you know, the fact that you were able to do that at 25, not a lot of people, I think, you know, I'm very happy for you, and you're very lucky that it was when you didn't wake up at like 52 and be like, ah, shit.
Yeah, I wasted a lot. I mean, and even at 25, I wasted a lot of life. And you look at, you know, everything I believe turned out the way it was supposed to for me. But, you know, there's a lot of my 20s that I was not coherent for. And that I don't remember shit, even, you know, even my teenage years. And I remember my mom, you know, telling me as I was, you know, getting busted for smoking weed as a high school kid, you know, like one of her greatest regrets is that she just doesn't remember her life. And that it wasn't that, like, you know, weed is bad or that drugs are bad necessarily, but you want to be able to be coherent. You want to be able to feel and experience what this life is without having to numb yourself all the time. Because really, it's just kind of a blur from 15 to 25.
Sure.
I mean, I remember specific things, but it's there's a fog over it, and I don't want to live my entire life like that.
Well, I don't think it's – I mean, I know I've said that before too. Like, oh, I wasted my 20s. And like, yeah, but if you had to go through that experience to become the person you are
– Exactly.
You know, and in your case, let's say you write – and this is going to get super schmaltzy in Pollyanna, and I apologize. But let's say that got you to a point where you write a song like Same Love and it completely changes someone's life.
Exactly.
I mean, it's kind of like, well – maybe that wasn't wasted. Maybe I, you know, like maybe there was a process that I needed to go through to be able to, like, then it's, you know, you're here now and you're still only 29 and it's good. It's just, it's good.
That's exactly, I appreciate that.
I think there's a catch 22 to it where it's like, you can't live in that, but the experience you get of having the hindsight of having experienced it also changes you, I think,
true,
in a very dramatic and positive way.
True.
That it's almost, you have to go through that bad to get to a more complete person.
I always say no one became interesting by not fucking up.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, it's if you meet people like, everything's great.
Yeah. I don't get that.
Yeah, really?
What were you doing that whole time?
Yeah.
What's going on in your head? Is there a puppet show happening? Always? This is a delightful puppet show. So what's next? You're just sort of you're in the storm right now.
I'm in the storm. It's just a bunch of shows and press and trying to, you know, we started to get, you know, because Thrift Shop starts to take off and it starts, you know, 4 months ago or something. Starts to, you know, the radio stations start picking it up. YouTube plays start creeping up. You're like, wow, we're getting, you know, 100,000 hits a day. Oh, this is crazy.
Oh, you get that montage like from that thing you do where it's like number 10, number 8,
yes,
number 1.
Exactly. So that starts happening, you know, four months ago, 5 months ago. And, you know, then you start getting offers to do shows. And, you know, us, we're like, we got to get it while it's good.
Yeah.
We'll take every, you know, if the money's where it should be, then we'll take every single show. We pretty much booked 2013. 4 months ago. The year is like done. Yeah. Literally. Like we have like 2 weeks of free time in the entire year.
Wow.
So it's nothing. There's a lot of college shows. There's a lot of festivals going over to Europe. We just got back from New Zealand and Australia. Everything at this point is pretty much just performing for the rest of the year. And, you know, a lot of cool opportunities I'm sure will pop up as well. In terms of, award shows and, you know, SNL type stuff, TV type opportunities, but everything is pretty much performance from here on out.
Wow. That's comforting. And I would imagine a little like, ugh, at the same time.
Yeah. It's definitely a little, I mean, you want to live, you know, normal people go home at 5 o'clock, maybe 6, and they don't have to work on the weekends and, you know, they have a normal existence with dogs and cats and shit, and they get to walk those dogs and they get to hang out with their significant other and not only talk about, you know, everything that is Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. And
you get to take the fiance on the road?
Yeah. She's behind me right now.
It's usually a publicist sitting behind.
A publicist sitting behind. And then she also had her phone. I'm like, oh, she's got a lot of clients she's working with back there.
She must be really expensive.
You carry yourself very professionally.
She's a good publicist. Accompanies you to a podcast.
Do you ever have that moment where you're just like eating cantaloupe and you're in New Zealand backstage about to go on? You're just like, how did I have a 2-bedroom apartment in Seattle? Like, when did this happen?
Yeah. And cantaloupe too. Yes, you're right.
The green rooms, man.
Yeah, they all have cantaloupe. And peanut butter and jelly.
Keeps, yeah.
Peanut butter and jelly, some water, a couple Perriers.
Yeah. Man, that sounds like a writer. That's actually exactly accurate.
I had my comedy writer, like, I don't know, someone put all this crazy shit in it. So it was like, I would show up these places and there would be like a deli tray for 30 people. And I'd be like, I'm not eating this by myself. Please don't waste all this meat and cheese and grapes. Like, give it to somebody.
Yeah.
So I finally was like, please take that out. I just want water. Just a water.
Is that your writer?
That's it. Water. Just water. Just water's fine.
You boring bastard.
I am so boring.
Yeah.
I am so boring.
You should
boring.
Throw something exciting on it. Like,
get some
I want
fruit snacks
a
on
random
there.
Nintendo cartridge available in the back.
Oh, yeah. Or, like, you know, go dig up one of the E.T. games.
Exactly.
And then just have it. Yeah, that's a good
idea.
All
those Tiger video games available in my green room.
I would like some, a couple, I'd like 6 bottles of water and a flautist.
The Stooges have a Bob Hope impersonator is on their rider. They need a Bob Hope impersonator backstage.
Do you think that's just to see if they'll
People
do it?
Paying attention.
If anybody will ever do that.
Be fair,
that.
If you do, you win. If you don't, that's insane anyways.
And then the guy in that town who's the Bob Hope is like, yay, I get to work today. Until then, it's nothing. But it was really nice talking to you.
Yeah.
This was an absolute pleasure. Man. And again, I know I understand the travel drill, so I know that coming here straight from the airport, it is not the most fun thing to have to do in the world, but I appreciate it. And I know that people are going to love to, you know, I think the other fun thing is that, you know, people see your work on YouTube and I think it's nice to hear you talk like a person like it sort of humanizes. I don't know. I think it's nice and I think people will dig it.
No, I appreciate it.
So
it's I'm a fan of the podcast and you guys are awesome and appreciate you having me.
Well, thanks, man. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. And thank you for, and I'm sorry, I thought you were a publicist.
You should marry that publicist.
All right. I'm going to do it now.
Oh my God.
Hey, publicist. Will you marry me?
We can't. We have an interview at 5.
You're good.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.